This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Abraham Lincoln said that a house divided against itself cannot stand.
The question is on the adoption of the resolution. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
So what might it mean that all but two House Democrats voted for the impeachment inquiry into President Trump, and every Republican voted against it? We'll break down the inquiry along with the rest of the nation's top stories. And joining us here in studio to help with that is Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent. Anita, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Asawin Subsang is White House reporter for The Daily Beast. Swin, welcome.
Always a pleasure.
And Byron York, chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome.
Good to be here.
Good to have your questions and thoughts as well on the week's top stories. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. And of course, impeachment is where we need to start the hour, because yesterday, the House voted, right along party lines, as we said, to formally open an impeachment inquiry into President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. Here is House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, followed by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, as they spoke ahead of the vote yesterday morning.
This resolution sets the stage for the next phase of our investigation, one in which the American people will have the opportunity to hear from the witnesses firsthand.
Sadly, this is not any cause for any glee or comfort. This is something that is very solemn, that is something prayerful, and that we had to gather so much information to take us to this next step.
Now, the resolution passed 231 to 196. Every Republican and two Democrats voted against it. House Minority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana was one of the vocal opponents.
When you look through this resolution in multiple places, it gives veto authority by the chair to literally reject any witness that's brought forward by the minority. So no rights for the minority unless the chair so designates. In fact, in this resolution, it allows the chair to veto even the ability for the president to have legal counsel in the room. If the chair chooses at his whim, they can literally kick out the president's legal counsel. This is unprecedented. It's not only unprecedented, this is Soviet-style rules.
Anita Kumar, let's back up from the political rhetoric for a minute. Explain exactly what this vote was and what it did.
This vote is a process vote. So the House Democrats are still going to investigate the president. The impeachment inquiry continues. What it will do was sort of set the parameters on how this was going to go forward. So in a week's time, things will be public. So everything's been behind closed doors. The biggest part of this is that the American people are going to see this. But it also sets the parameters on how many minutes the questions can be, and who can ask and how they can ask. It also sets the parameters for the president, how he can defend himself. So it was not unexpected, but kind of a big move, because we're going to see this all take place now on television where we haven't seen that before.
And when we say things will be public, Anita, that doesn't necessarily mean everything that has been behind closed doors will now be made public.
No, but the House Democrats do want to release some of the documents and some more information. Obviously, we've seen a lot of leaks come out, so we know sort of what's happened, but we don't know everything that's happened. Some of these depositions, testimonies that they've had the last few weeks have been 8-10 hours long. So we're getting just a fraction of that information. So we'll start to see things in about a week's time, and I think that will really shift it. It'll give us a lot more public scrutiny than it's had.
Byron, I'd love to get your sense of this mostly party line vote. Republicans have been complaining about the closed door hearings for weeks, though it should be noted that there are some GOP members on the committees that are questioning witnesses that have been included in the hearings. But they've also been asking for this process to be much more public than it has been so far. It seemed like there was almost no way for this vote to go, but straight down party lines.
Exactly. I get the sense that the sides are hardening on this. You see it in the polls, in which Americans are split almost 50-50 on this. And you see it on Capitol Hill. And I think we've gotten news in the last day or so that Democrats seem to believe they've pretty much gotten what they can get on this Ukraine investigation from these depositions that Anita was talking about. And basically what they want to do now They've got a few more to do, but they want to get their handful of most effective anti-Trump witnesses and build a TV show around them, put them on television and have them tell their story. This is precisely what they said after the release of the Mueller report. They said, well, people don't really understand this. If we make an effective presentation on television, there'll be maybe a Watergate moment and it'll be great. But it really appears, I mean, to me, it's World Series week. This is like a baseball play. This is a disputed play. Everybody's looking at the same replay, and half the people are saying he's out, and half the people are saying he's safe, and they're not going to change.
Although it is worth noting, Byron, I hear you in terms of the television aspect, that I understand why Democrats might think that. They might want, or they might believe that they can have like an Alexander Butterfield moment where they right. ask just the sure. right question, and there's this dramatic pause. And then he tells the truth, and then that blows the whole thing open.
That is that's kind of an Aaron Sorkin thing.
Yeah.
Maybe he could do this. But the other thing about this resolution is Steve Scalise's complaints, in my view, are justified, but they're also totally expected. This is what the 2018 election was about. The Democrats control the House, and they're going to do that. On the other hand, this bill vests extraordinary power in Adam Schiff, and Adam Schiff alone. If, you know, do we want to call some hearings? Well, Adam Schiff will decide that. Do you want to have witnesses? Well, you can ask Adam Schiff. He can or cannot give them to you as he chooses. Do you want these deposition transcripts released? He can release them, but again, he doesn't have to. Extraordinary power. Nancy Pelosi is kind of like the chairman of the board here, and she has designated Adam Schiff as the CEO of this impeachment.
Swin, to that point, I wonder if this presents some kind of a risk, both in the nature of the straight party line vote and also to the Democrats, because of, you know, the unanimous vociferous opposition from the GOP, of course, but also just the nature of it. I mean, if Adam Schiff is imbued with so much of this power, it makes him a very easy whipping boy for the GOP. It makes him the person that you can put on ads that run in the 2020 election. It feels like, I don't know, the Republicans almost have individuals they can point to and say, see, that's the person who's screwing this up.
Sure, absolutely. But I mean, at this point, is there a single thing that Democrats could do, whether it's in terms of process or messaging or anything, that isn't going to be played that way by the other side? I'm just absolutely unconvinced, especially not just having lived through the past 2 or 3 years, but the past, oh, I don't know, several decades of Republican messaging going back to the Clinton era, that there was anything that they could do to not have it played up in the way you're talking about. So, I mean, fine, we can have process arguments, but I think ultimately it's sort of meaningless. And it's a little bit rich to hear some of this coming from the same congressional Republicans if you examine even an iota of the way that they acted in the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. But that's a bigger nut to crack that we can perhaps get into later. But they're going to keep hollering on about Soviet style, this and that, till the end of the time, because they think it's messaging that works. And have at it. But at this point, people in the upper echelons of Trump world who I've talked to, unsurprisingly, have all determined that impeachment at the hands of the House Democrats is a foregone conclusion. The president of the United States has come around to that as well, even though at the beginning of this whole impeachment inquiry, he kind of went back and forth when he was talking to people privately about whether he thought Democrats and Nancy Pelosi were actually going to pull the trigger. Some of his legal counsel, such as Jay Sekulow, said the exact same stuff on the record weeks ago, obviously singing it different to now. So, I mean, that's baked in. I don't think that surprises anybody, especially at this point. But something that President Trump has been privately complaining about for May days, if not weeks, is that he believed that Senate Republicans, not House Republicans, but Senate Republicans had not been fighting for him hard enough, had not been messaging hardcore enough, had not been pulling out enough theatrics or dirty tactics or whatever you want to call it. But even though they're now pulling out all the stops in the West Wing to ensure that Republicans, if it gets to the Senate, clear the president's name, acquit him, they're still convinced that that's the way it's going to go. I mean, I think that's the conventional wisdom. I think it's right. Like, you are not going to see a President Pence in 2020. It's just not going
to
happen.
Well, and Anita, partly to the point that Swin was making in terms of what Republican senators might do, Ed in Illinois asked, can the Republican-led Senate subpoena texts, emails, phone records of House leaders to see if they were releasing info from closed-door hearings to the media or had already made up their minds before the process even began, as Republicans have been saying all along?
I don't think that Mitch McConnell is interested in any of that. Remember, he is the leader, the Republican leader of the Senate. He has said that he would be legally obliged to bring this up if there's sort of a trial phase here. So,
and bring it up swiftly.
Bring it up swiftly. That doesn't mean it's going to be a full trial as we might think. We don't know what that means exactly, but I don't think he's interested in getting into all of that. I think he's interested in dismissing this pretty summarily. I mean, we know as of now, right now, there's no votes in the Senate for this, for Senate Republicans. There are not enough votes to basically remove the president from office.
And Byron Drew tweeted, as an independent, I believe both parties are exhibiting bad form with zero transparency for the American public. We'll talk more about this in a minute, but, you know, independents are the plurality, if not the majority, of the electorate, and they're looking at this thinking about 2020.
Everybody's looking at it thinking about 2020. I mean, excluding 1868, which is kind of a different thing, in the last two impeachments, Nixon and Clinton, both presidents, were impeached after they had been reelected in 1972 and 1996, respectively. We haven't had one in the modern era in which the party that is seeking to defeat the president a year from now is now impeaching him. And clearly some Democrats believe that if they do it right, this impeachment will damage the president going into the election.
We'll pick up there when we continue the roundup with Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Swin Subsang of the Daily Beast, and Politico's Anita Kumar. As we go to break, you're listening to Spanish Moon by the 70s rock band Little Feat. Its guitarist Paul Barrer died this week at the age of 71. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. New employment numbers out today show the job market has lost some momentum. The economy added 128,000 jobs in October. Job growth over the prior 3 months had averaged higher than that, at 176,000 jobs per month. Many economists expected a drop last month because of the General Motors strike, which cut 50,000 workers from the employment rolls. That strike is over, which could improve this month's report. It's the Friday News Roundup with Politico's Anita Kumar, Swin Subsang of the Daily Beast, and Byron York of the Washington Examiner. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's news, so comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Matt tweeted, I am pro-impeachment, but I don't know how we get back to normal after this. I believe this political divide will be the new norm going forward. It seems the American experiment is irreparably damaged, and I don't see things changing in my lifetime, and I'm only 35. Swin, could you react to that? Partly because we've always had a political divide.
Right.
It's always been nasty around impeachment. Like, this is not... This may feel more acute because of, say, social media and 24-hour cable news. I mean, Matt and I are not far off in age, but this ain't new.
I didn't live through the 1960s or the early 70s, but I hear some stuff happened there.
And, one or two things, yeah.
Yeah, at least one or two things.
Right.
And I get what people are saying. You see what plays on TV, radio, whatever, every day. You see stuff on social media. You see the polls that have been coming out since the Obama era that do seem to indicate that, at least as far as public polling goes, that there is more of an emphatically stated and publicly known political divide than we've seen in maybe years or decades past. And I don't want to discount that or downplay that, but and I don't mean to sound like a little bit of a nihilist about it, but I mean, just from what I've read in history textbooks, online, in nonfiction books, I have a hard time believing that the Nixon era was comfier than it is now, not just in terms of political polarization and intense divides over the Vietnam War and other issues, but even on pet issues of the national press, such as war on the press issues. Like, Nixon was worse than President Trump was on that, especially messaging. There were top henchmen of Nixon who actually started planning out as literal assassination of a journalist.
Well, and Spiro Agnew was very open in saying that perhaps we should look for the problem not in the halls of power in Washington, but in the,
right.
The television networks of New York.
So Donald Trump adds a reality TV flair to a lot of this stuff, but it's not new. to think it's an aberration of the American political character is wrong. It is very much intrinsic to it.
And Matt, by the way, we're doing a program on Monday, if this concerns you, that you might be interested in. Stick around. I'll tell you more about that a little bit later on. Anita, I'd like you to respond to a question from Aaron, who asked on our Facebook page, can the panel please compare these rules, or maybe anyone on the panel, since Aaron is asking it to all three of you, can the panel please compare these rules on the impeachment investigation to the ones passed by the Republican House during the Clinton impeachment? How are they the same, and how do they differ?
My understanding is they're pretty similar. Maybe it's correct that the chairman of the committees have more power in this scenario, but I believe that basically the majority party had the power just like this, and the minority was allowed to do certain things. So it's generally the same.
We also, Byron, have gone from the era of like an independent counsel to a very different kind of process. So the rules may be the same, but the investigative process around the inquiry is
well,
not.
Well, yeah, I was about to say this. In the Watergate era, the Watergate hearings in the Senate had taken place in 1973. They were before the House got around to it. And then in the Clinton years, there was an independent counsel, Kenneth Starr, who investigated all the stuff and gave a very detailed report based on grand jury testimony to the House, which they used as their roadmap for impeachment. Even in the Mueller period, we had a special prosecutor putting together a report and then making it public, essentially giving it to Congress. What's different here is, since Democrats jumped on this Ukraine thing so fast, I mean, you remember Nancy Pelosi announced an inquiry the day before the president released the rough transcript of the telephone call. The House is functioning kind of as the investigative body, too. And that's the source of a lot of this friction with these secret depositions. I'm one of these ones who's been saying they should be made public. They don't have to be held in public. That's not necessary. But we do need to see transcripts of what was actually said in these things. So it's this investigative function that people are fighting over so much. And only then, I guess, the Intelligence Committee is kind of functioning as the independent counsel, then they'll send it over to the Judiciary Committee, and it'll be more like a traditional impeachment.
Speaking of the behind-closed-doors testimony, Swin, we've learned quite a bit this week from some of the folks who testified. We've heard from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vintman, who is the National Security Council's top Ukraine expert, Tom Morrison, who is the Director of European Affairs for the NSC. Some of the committees are still trying to get John Bolton to testify. They've scheduled him for next week, at least. What are the one or two big things that we learned from this week's testimony, at least what we could glean from sources who talked about the testimony?
I mean, the biggest element of it, and it's something that whether you're talking to a Republican politician or a Democratic politician, they'll spin it in different ways. But basically, the hard facts of what these people keep corroborating is that they believe there was, in essence, a quid pro quo being executed by Trump and some of his top officials with regards to his dealings with the Ukrainian president, military aid, and trying to get multiple investigations publicly announced by the Ukrainians, including but not limited to looking into Joe and Hunter Biden. Joe Biden, obviously headed into an election year, is going to be, or likely going to be, one of Trump's top political foes on the Democratic side. So right now we're sort of haggling over the price of this, with conservatives and pro-Trump allies saying differing versions of what's the big deal. And obviously Democratic foes of the president saying that this is Watergate 2.0, Iran-Contra 2.0, whatever you want to call it. But when it comes to President Trump himself, he will not stop saying that it was a perfect phone call and that this changes nothing. Where's the whistleblower? Even though we've had enough testimony from people on the record, well, behind closed doors, that is, that seems to be corroborating what the whistleblower is saying. So the president continues to have this fixation, as do a lot of Republicans, on this anonymous whistleblower, whereas you could argue at this point it doesn't really matter what the identity of the whistleblower is if there are all these other names, people putting their names to things that the whistleblower was alleging in the anonymous complaint.
If they're corroborating what was in the complaint. We want to move on from impeachment because, there, believe it or not, there was other news in Washington this week. But Anita, what should we expect next week?
Well, there's eight more people scheduled to give these to talk to Congress. We don't know if all of those people will show up. That's basically the thing we wonder every day. Are these people going to cooperate or not? What I've been surprised about is how many people have cooperated, decided to come forward, sometimes with a subpoena, mostly with a subpoena. So we have these eight more coming, and then the week after is when things will start to become public.
Before we move on, look, I know that this story is dizzying. This is like a Game of Thrones-esque storyline that just keeps changing and changing. There's a really easy reference guide online. It's npr.org/impeachment. It has all the details, the timeline of everything, who's who, all the related documents, a tracker of who supports impeachment, who doesn't support impeachment, and it'll be updated as the story continues to move. So if you ever find yourself just your eyes crossing because this is getting complicated, your best bet for one-stop summary of everything is npr.org/impeachment. Another story out of Capitol Hill this week involved California Congresswoman Katie Hill. She was a freshman Democrat who won a long-held Republican seat last year. Congresswoman Hill announced that she's resigning. Now, this happened after nude photos of her were published by some conservative websites and amid an ethics probe into whether she had inappropriate relationships with House staffers. Here is part of what she said on the House floor in discussing her resignation.
I am leaving now because of a double standard. I am leaving because I no longer want to be used as a bargaining chip. I'm leaving because I didn't want to be peddled by papers and blogs and websites used by shameless operatives for the dirtiest gutter politics that I've ever seen, and the right-wing media to drive clicks and expand their audience by distributing intimate photos of me taken without my knowledge, let alone my consent, for the sexual entertainment of millions. I'm leaving because of a misogynistic culture that gleefully consumed my naked pictures, capitalized on my sexuality, and enabled my abusive ex to continue that abuse, this time with the entire country watching. I am leaving because of the thousands of vile, threatening emails, calls, and texts that made me fear for my life and the lives of the people that I care about.
That was California Democratic Congresswoman Katie Hill speaking on the House floor. Anita, I'm wondering what your sense is of what the story is here. There's the ethics piece of this, and then there's just the revenge porn piece of this. Congresswoman Hill maintains that she is the victim of an abusive ex who is trying to get back at her and that her devices were hacked to release pictures that were on them. What's the real story here as you see it?
Well, I think there's a couple things. She has said that she's going to leave office and continue to sort of be an advocate and talk about these things, the revenge porn. I really think the thing is what she was talking about, that this is the thing that's going to get a lot of attention going forward is, are men and women treated differently? You know, these rules that she is accused of violating, having a relationship with one of her staffers, which she denies, is a new rule that came up after the Me Too movement. And it's sort of ironic that the first person that's sort of caught up in this is a woman and not a man, because the allegation is that there have been men that have violated, that have had relationships with staffers, even when, you know, they might have been unethical, but it wasn't on the books as something that was, you know, inappropriate by House rules. So here we are a year later, and it's a woman that has been caught up in this. Now, she's denying this. There are allegations that she did do something wrong, and we don't know that. But I do think there's a lot of attention paid by a lot of women that men and women are treated differently.
Byron, I wonder what your sense is of how Congress has responded. I mean, Florida Republican Matt Gaetz told Fox News last night there's a generational divide on Hill's resignation and that many millennials can identify with what Hill is experiencing. I haven't heard much. Granted, the whole impeachment inquiry thing has drowned out everything. But I haven't heard a whole lot about this, including the fact that one of the people who has announced that he wants to run for her seat is George Papadopoulos, who is the man who literally touched off the Mueller probe.
Well, I mean, there have been reports that Nancy Pelosi said privately of course, Nancy Pelosi is nearly 80 years old and grew up in a time when not everyone had a cell phone camera in their pocket, said you got to be really careful about the pictures that are taken of you and what are done. There's a battle going on about what this the Katie Hill case means. Is it a feminist issue or is it an issue of being improperly involved with staff? And I believe one of the nude pictures, correct me if I'm wrong, was of her naked with a campaign staffer. not one of her Hill staffers, but a campaign staffer. And there was this allegation that she also had an improper relationship with a Hill staffer as well. And that's a fair amount of stuff, regardless of the party, the naked bong party pictures.
This is a pure ethics matter.
Which were in, well, absolutely.
Just pointing out, she did admit that she had the relationship with the campaign staffer.
Yeah. Right.
Right. The open question, which may or may not get resolved at this point, is, as the people here have pointed out, is the allegation, which she still emphatically denies, even though she's copped to the other one, as Anita just pointed out, did she have an inappropriate relationship with a congressional staffer? Which, of course, if that did violate ethics rules, she should be held accountable to that, as would a male in her position. So there's nothing misogynistic or sexist about that. In fact, that would be the exact opposite. But thing is, now that she's resigning, we're not going to get to that point, and this allegation may just stand unanswered for God knows how long. And it's so two things can be true at once. If she did do that, which again she emphatically denies, I don't think anybody here knows if she did or didn't, then that would be wrong via House rules. And also you can highlight the abhorrent nature of the revenge porn aspect of the story. Two things can be true at once. There doesn't need to be a perfect hero here on either side. And the some of the coverage of it, including like the naked bong photo, like at the end of the day, I mean, who cares? Who's being hurt there? What rule is being violated? What's the impropriety? What is the point of airing someone's dirty laundry like that in the national press except to humiliate and degrade? There's no ethical question to that on the side of holding Katie Hill accountable.
So this is one ethical gray area that the political sphere is dealing with. Another story dealing with another ethical gray area had to do with the nature of social media and the upcoming election. Facebook's gotten a lot of flack, obviously, for the impact of Russian interference in 2016. This week, the CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, announced his decision to stop all political advertising on Twitter around the world. He sent out a tweet thread explaining the decision. Of course he did. He's the CEO of Twitter. And it reads in part, quote, "This isn't about free expression. This is about paying for reach. And paying to increase the reach of political speech has significant ramifications that today's democratic infrastructure may not be prepared to handle. It's worth stepping back in order to address," unquote. Anita, many people who have applauded this decision are now looking at Facebook and saying, okay, your turn. I think that if Jack Dorsey had been the owner of the Washington Post instead of Twitter, he could have been taken to the Supreme Court and lost, because paid political speech is free speech. But he's right. This is one of those gray areas where we really don't have a good answer.
We don't. But he didn't mention Facebook, but that's sort of the subtext here,
yeah,
which is, okay, we've done our part. What about you, Facebook? And you saw Hillary Clinton and you saw other people now saying, hey, they acted. Where's Facebook on this? And we know where they are. They have said that that they do not plan to ban this, that they can't determine whether political ads are correct or not, and it shouldn't matter. That's people should be able to take out ads. Important to note that this is each year that comes by, this becomes a bigger deal, right? Social media is taking on a bigger life every day. It's a $6 billion industry in terms of these political ads. So it is significant, perhaps more significant on the money part to Facebook than Twitter, but it's a step that a lot of Democrats want to see happen.
Jay wrote on our Facebook page, regarding Twitter and political advertising, the political problem on social media, especially Twitter, isn't political advertising. The problem is incendiary political speech, libel, lies, and blatant misrepresentation. Donald Trump has arguably amassed much of his social capital by consistently violating the terms of service at Twitter and circulating the most vile and untruthful content of any public figure. Byron, I'd like you to react to that when we come back. I mean, I don't think Donald Trump needs to pay for political ads to have influence on Twitter, so I kind of wonder how far this will actually go. As we go to break, we'll be playing Friday by Ice Cube. You may remember the guy that played his dad in the Friday movies, John Witherspoon. He passed away this week at the age of 77. He had an amazing comedy career that spanned decades, including playing the voice of Granddad on the animated series The Boondocks. Stay close. Just seen them in the driveway, getting beat like a smoker, boom, because it's Friday. Oh, yeah, throw your neighborhood in the air if you don't care. Oh, yeah, throw your neighborhood in the air if you don't care. Back now to the roundup with Anita Kumar, Swin Subsang, and Byron York. Byron, let's pick up with that comment from Jay, who wrote on our Facebook page, "The political problem on social media, especially Twitter, isn't political advertising. The problem is incendiary political speech, libel, lies, and blatant misrepresentation. Donald Trump has arguably amassed much of his social capital by consistently violating the terms of service at Twitter and circulating the most vile and untruthful content of any public figure." He has broken the terms of service quite a bit, including, I think, with that video where he took footage from the movie Kingsman: The Secret Service and superimposed the logos of news organizations over the heads of people who the main character massacres in a church.
Trump didn't tweet that, though.
But he retweeted it.
Really?
He did. Yes. I mean, he spread that tweet around. So, but even beyond that, if I had tweeted some of the things the president had, I would be banned for life.
Well, I think that Twitter almost has a presidential exception for this, that when Trump does something, it's by definition news, and they allow it to appear.
I thought you were going to quote Richard Nixon from the Frost interview, "When the president tweets it, it's not illegal." I'm sorry. I thought that was where you were going.
On this ad thing, I have to say my opinion, I'm on Facebook's side on this. Their position is basically that political speech is not only some of the most important speech in our national conversation, it's some of the most scrutinized speech in our national conversation, and that scrutiny should be done by journalists and political opponents and not a group of techies at Facebook. I should say here, because I have to, that I was one of the small number of conservative journalists who went out to Palo Alto and had dinner at Zuckerberg's house, an off-the-record dinner. Another point that he makes, and it made in his speech at Georgetown, is that it's hard to figure out what is a political ad. We have ads that are done by the Trump campaign or the Warren campaign, but there are tons of advocacy groups that post ads related to an election. It's a very, very large subject, and with lines that are very difficult to draw once you start drawing them.
And Swin, I think Facebook's leadership in particular has been much more, at least visibly, engaged with Capitol Hill in terms of saying, we agree that we need to have a conversation. We agree there need to be regulations. We want to be part of the discussion so that something is not imposed on them that they dislike. Jack Dorsey has been a little bit more reticent, but I don't know that Mark Zuckerberg's openness has gained him fans on Capitol Hill.
No, I don't think so. And actually, a little interesting subplot of this whole Zuckerberg-related saga is, if you look at what his image was in the mid-Obama era and the perception among a lot of establishment Democrats of him, it was resoundingly more positive. They saw him as a tech giant ally. The group he helped started, it was heralded as something that would help push through immigration reform finally in the Obama era. Obviously, that did not happen. And a lot of this is because of hurt feelings over the 2016 election. I'm sorry to say, not all of it, but some of it is because a lot of Democrats, activists, some politicians, what have you, do think that Facebook helped elect Donald Trump with the misinformation that was spread on it. And it has contributed somewhat, not entirely, but somewhat to Zuckerberg's image or perception as a villain among a good chunk of the progressive base, which is 100% contra to how he was perceived in the mid-Obama era. Now, they don't think he's a closet conservative. They don't think he's running around wearing the MAGA hat. But a lot of progressives who have already started to see big tech as a monopoly and a deleterious force that does need more regulation or oversight, has started to point to Zuckerberg more and more and more. And that trend will continue. And none of that is gaining Zuckerberg any new friends on the right. But that's a whole different question.
Kay in Silver Spring, Maryland emailed, "Why is the CEO of Boeing not being considered as a criminal rather than just being asked to step down? Interesting question, Kay, but Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg was on Capitol Hill this week. He apologized Tuesday to the families of those who died in two 737 MAX jet crashes within the last year. He made the apology 1 year after the first crash, a Lion Air jetliner, as he testified in front of a Senate committee.
On behalf of myself and the Boeing company, we are sorry, deeply and truly sorry. As a husband and father myself, I'm heartbroken by your losses.
Muilenburg also appeared before a House committee on Wednesday, and he said in part, quote, "Regulators around the world should approve the return of the MAX to the skies only after they have applied the most rigorous scrutiny and are completely satisfied as to the plane's safety," unquote. This is the first time that Boeing executives have testified since the Lion Air and Ethiopian Airlines jetliners crashed. 20 people who lost loved ones in the Ethiopian Airlines crash were at the Tuesday hearing. Let's back up to some of the politics surrounding the president, Anita, with one comment from John that I'd like to get your reaction to. John wrote on our Facebook page, "It's becoming rather clear that the Republicans are afraid of their own base and will happily throw themselves on a live grenade to protect this president. In the end, does it matter? The actual precedent that buries Trump is state tax fraud crimes in New York."
Well, I mean, it's true about the Republicans here. I mean, no matter what you say, no matter what has happened, what controversy over the last 2.5 years, the president seems to remain popular with a certain segment of the society. His supporters are sticking with him. And so you see Republicans on Capitol Hill that feel that they need to stick with the president. Those that haven't stuck with him are retiring, or they are going to be primaried, and they sort of know that political future. So people have stuck with him. What the person is referring to on the tax fraud, you know, I think there's a lot of investigations that the president is going through. I mean, we're so caught up in Washington with the impeachment and the Ukraine call, we forget. You know, I did a story that there were 15 outside investigations into Donald Trump all over the country on taxes, on his business, on so many other things. And some of those are criminal investigations. All of those are criminal investigations. He has lawsuits. So there's a lot more that could come out that we might see in the next year that is outside of Washington. And the caller is correct, or the person that's writing in is correct, that any of those things can come true. And I don't know that we have all that information yet.
Well, but briefly, Byron, even if those did, you know, come to light, there's still the question as to whether or not you can even charge a sitting president. So even then, it would have to wait until after he's out of office.
I do think through all the investigations of the past 3 years, among some Democrats, there's been this belief that there's always something big just around the corner. I mean, this collusion is really huge. And then when it's not turning out to be quite as huge, you know, this New York stuff, it's really big. SDNY is really going to get him. How about emoluments? How about his other business deals? How about Ukraine? Now Ukraine is the really big thing. I think that there's almost a Roadrunner Wile E. Coyote characteristic to this. And so far, nothing has turned out to be exactly what they hoped. Now we're in the middle of perhaps the biggest project yet, with the House actually impeaching him. But so far, it hasn't really worked the way they hoped.
We should note on the West Coast that the National Weather Service has issued its first ever extreme red flag warning this week as parts of California continue to burn. Fires are burning up and down the state, fueled by rushing winds. They came within a few feet of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. That fire is still burning, but the library plans to be open today. Reports suggest that firefighters are starting to get a handle on the Kincade Fire, which is north of San Francisco. Yesterday, a new fire broke out northwest of Los Angeles in Ventura County. Forecasters expect strong winds and low humidity in Southern California. Parts of Northern California woke up to a freeze warning, but temperatures should still rise above normal this weekend. We should also talk about Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi before we go. On Sunday, the president shared new details of the raid that killed the ISIS leader. Here's part of what he said in a televised address from the White House.
The U.S. personnel were incredible. I got to watch much of it. No personnel were lost in the operation, while a large number of Baghdadi's fighters and companions were killed with him. He died after running into a dead-end tunnel, whimpering and crying and screaming all the way.
Now, Anita, some of the national security officials, including the defense secretary, Mark Esper, have called some of the details of that into question. What do we actually know about what happened?
Well, you're exactly right. There are U.S. officials who are saying they don't know those specific details that the president was talking about, that how he acted like a coward at the end and he whimpered like a dog, I think he said. So those details aren't known. What we do know is he was killed. We do know some of those details that the president said are exactly true. But this is a president we've seen over and over who likes to have things as a sort of theatrical. He likes to embellish. He likes to tell a good story. He likes to be on TV telling that. And so although it has made some of his officials uncomfortable, some of the details that he's revealed and the way he reveals it, that is the way he continues to do it.
And Swin, one of the other aspects of this in announcing al-Baghdadi's death is that the president kind of departed from his standard criticism of the intelligence community. He praised their work, but he also said he's dealing with, in his words, people who aren't very intelligent having to do with intel. So a little bit of a pullback, but still not completely.
Other Trumpian flourishes that he couldn't help but not divert from when he was giving this pretty important national address wasn't just what you just talked about, but he also took time to say that ISIS is pretty good at social media, but not as great as Donald Trump is. And he also referenced multiple times, not just one, but multiple best-selling books of his. And how right he was in one of them, allegedly, about Osama bin Laden before the 9/11 attacks happened. So during the course of this, we have multiple senior administration officials, both on the record and otherwise, saying that they have no idea where the president got the crying and whimpering details, alleged details of Baghdadi's violent passing. And we have him pimping both his best-selling books from years and decades past, and how great he is at Twitter.com. I can't think of any other way this particular president would have announced the death of the ISIS leader.
Byron, one more thing we should note, that on Wednesday, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa and Homeland Security Committee Chairman Ron Johnson of Wisconsin asked the Attorney General to make the DOJ's Russia investigation findings public. Why did they ask for that briefly?
Well, this came after news that it had, this is the John Durham investigation, had turned into a criminal investigation, that Durham was using a grand jury to get evidence. And I think there's a fear. There's a balance between a criminal procedure and public disclosure. And most Republicans on the Hill want public disclosure. And when something becomes a criminal case, people lawyer up. There's a grand jury involved. There's secrecy involved. And that's exactly the opposite of what a number of Republicans want. I think they don't want to hang anybody. They want the public to know what happened.
Before we go, the impeachment process that we've been talking about today is rightly being called historic. But the Washington Nationals rewrote some of the history books on Wednesday night. An estimated 27 million people watched them beat the Houston Astros in Game 7 to win the World Series. D.C. has not won in 95 years, back when a team called the Senators took the title. This year's championship broke a lot of records. The Nationals had the worst start ever for a championship team. They'd lost 31 of their first 50 games. This was the first World Series where the visiting team won every game. The Nats also had the league's oldest roster, with an average age of about 31. Washington's Fernando Rodney is the oldest active player in the majors. He's 42. Some of the Nats call themselves Los Viejos, which is Spanish for the old guys. And the Nats have a strong Latino presence. Their victory song is Calma, a reggaeton hit celebrating the beauty of Puerto Rico. The team's other anthem is the walk-on music for Gerardo Parra, Baby Shark. You can expect to hear that at tomorrow's parade, like it or not. The celebration will run along the National Mall from the Washington Monument east to the Capitol. Baseball has a way of sparing us from the crises of the day. Back in 1998, I remember the home run race between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa giving me a break from President Clinton's scandal over Monica Lewinsky. Many New Yorkers took pride in the first game after 9/11. The Mets beat the Braves 3-2. The Yankees made it to that World Series, where a tattered flag from Ground Zero waved over the crowd in Game 3. This impeachment is historic, but history's made all the time. And not always through tragedy. Well, Astros fans might consider this a tragedy, but you know what I mean. The point is, look, Whatever may happen with Congress and President Trump, we'll bring you the latest. But there's always more to life than politics. And as vital as it is for us to keep a close eye on Washington, sometimes it really is okay to look away. Anita Kumar is Politico's White House correspondent. Anita, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thanks.
Aswin Subsang, White House reporter for The Daily Beast. Thank you, Swin.
Anytime.
And Byron York, Chief Political Correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Thanks, Byron.
Thanks for having me.
Please do subscribe to 1A's podcast on whatever app you like. If you like the show, please rate us and write a review. All the links to listen are at npr.org/1A. Our lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Mionai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Chris Castano. To learn more about them and the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy your weekend and the victory parade. This is 1A.